Blog Talk Radio.
People make the world go round.
This is Leslie Gist, and you're listening to the Antique E Show. And tonight we have a very special guest, an author and a professor, Christopher Parker. Are you on the line, Christopher?
Yes, I'm here, Leslie.
Great. I'm so glad that we were able to connect. I was getting a little worried because this is the first time I had a guest on who I haven't spoken to over the phone. So
that's fine.
I'm glad you were able to make it. I checked out your website and the university website, and I learned a lot about you and your books. Could you just introduce yourself to our guests?
Most certainly. Thank you for having me on your show, Leslie. My name is Christopher Parker. I'm with the faculty in the Department of Political Science at the University of Washington in Seattle. I teach courses on African-American politics, but more specifically, courses on African-American social and political thought, introduction to African-American politics. And I've written some recent stuff on, you know, Obama and the role of race, racism and patriotism on the 2008 elections.
Okay, and what kind of feedback did you get from your writings about Obama?
This was mainly for a refereed, like more scholarly audience, but I have gotten some feedback from from some of my neighbors. I distributed around the neighborhood, and I live. My wife and I, or my family, we're the only black family, perhaps within 20 blocks. And some of my neighbors, you know, liked it a lot. Some of them had some really hard questions about it, but you know, that's to be expected.
Okay, I'm curious what. What was one of the most profound questions that you needed to ask?
So basically I had a couple of them that asked me, whether or not race still, they questioned whether or not race really mattered or continues to matter. It should be noted, however, that, you know, they're dyed in the wool Republican, so I expected as much.
Okay. So do you think race matters?
Of course. I think race still matters. It continues to do so. It won't go away for quite some time. And I think it's playing a pretty huge part in the resistance to President Obama's domestic agenda. Now, that's not to say that it's going to be an overwhelming factor, right? But all I'm saying is that it's not zero at this time, and that it's going to continue to matter.
Okay. All right. Now, how does your first book, and the title of your first book is Fighting For?
It's called Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans, and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Post-War South.
Now, do you see any parallels between your first book and what you just recently wrote about Obama? Do you see anything, any similarities?
No, not really. That you know, my first book is an extension of my doctoral thesis, and so I had to get that one done. This other piece was something that I felt like it needed to be written because of the times in which we live, and I just think that, you know, more needs to be said about. Well, there's a lot of people. Let me clarify that, Leslie. There are a lot of people right now writing on race and Obama and politics. As a political scientist, I felt like I needed to write something on it. And trust me, Leslie, there's no shortage of work, even in academic circles, that examine the Obama phenomenon. So I had to jump in there real quick and get my little piece in and then step out.
Okay. So how was it received by your colleagues?
My colleagues agreed with it. My colleagues are pretty cool. I mean, my colleagues are, you know, they're all very well educated. Obviously, all of them have PhDs. So, you know, and this is a piece of social science, right? So I just take the data, you know, I do what's called hypothesis testing, which is nothing more than testing claims that I make based on, you know, some theoretical observations. And basically, you know, I analyze the results and try to explain them. So from that perspective, I mean, it's really hard to argue with because I'm dealing with hard data. So everybody was cool with it.
Now, would you, you know, I'm hoping that future scholars are listening to the show or will be listening to it and download the show. And what you're doing is you're giving us the process of how a political scientist arrives at his conclusions. So
right.
If you don't mind, if you could just tell us the process as if you were giving us an assignment as a professor who was sitting in your classroom.
That's great. Okay, so this is how I would do this. So let's say there's a question you want to answer. In this particular case,
let's use your paper, the Obama paper.
Okay. So we run out of the University of Washington every year what's called the Washington Poll, and we sort of, you know, document the political attitudes and behavior of people in the state of Washington. Now, since the Obama fund, and we do this every year, like every November, right before the election. So obviously, you know, since Obama was on the ballot, I said, you know, we need to get some questions in here on race and, you know, and how racism is could possibly affect the way people feel about him and whether or not they're going to vote for him, right? So what I did was I just designed some survey questions and had them put it on the poll. And there's an existing sort of literature on different types of racism. And since I do patriotism as well, I said, let me put some stuff in here on patriotism and to see, you know, whether or not racism and patriotism affected, you know, what was going on in the election. Because think about it. Think about who his opposition was, right? John McCain and Sarah Palin, they're walking around all the time talking about patriotism and real Americans this, and Michelle's not patriotic because of that. And I'm like, let me just see if this really exists in the real world, right? So I put some questions on patriotism on the survey because of that. And then I also put some questions about different types of racism on the survey as well. So I had some idea about how these things should work, but it's one thing to sort of have an idea about something, right? And it's a different thing altogether to test it empirically to see if it really has an impact.
Now, give us an example of a question.
So one question on patriotism would say, I love my country. Being an American is an important part of my identity, right? And so the questions would be structured such that you strongly agree, you somewhat agree, you disagree, and you strongly disagree, right? So
right.
So that's an example of a question. And so based on how they answer that question, you know, controlling for other things, that will affect how they feel about Obama. Now, well, let me say this, Leslie. So what I found was this paper was about white attitudes and their behavior towards Obama. So what I found was lower class whites and working class whites who strongly agreed with that question on patriotism, they didn't support Obama, right? But middle and upper class whites who strongly agreed with that, they supported Obama.
Okay. Now, why do you think that phenomenon occurred?
Well, this is why I think this occurred, is because, you know, lower class and working class whites, they have a certain idea of what patriotism is for them. They have a more sort of xenophobic, and that, what I mean by that is this idea that, you know, they don't like foreigners or anybody that's not like them. So Americans to them, or patriotism to them, is restricted to people who look like them. That is to say, whites, right?
Okay.
Now, educated whites, they have a more nuanced understanding of what patriotism is. And for them, patriotism is about the values and the values and the beliefs on which the country was founded, you know,
right.
Tolerance, you know, equality, right? So these two groups of whites have different perspectives of patriotism. That's how I would explain the difference.
Now, do you think that these two groups had a difference as far as how long they've been Americans? You know, are they first, second generation immigrants?
Oh, no. Everybody in this survey was born in the United States.
Okay.
So these aren't white immigrants. These are folks who have been born and raised here their whole lives.
All right, because I'm curious to find out the differences between a first-generation American versus a, let's say, fifth-generation white American.
I can probably speculate on that just a little bit. So first generations, I mean, regardless of what the national origins are, you know, they're going to be a lot more dogmatic in American political values and behavior. But now let me say this though, but they're also very sort of hostile towards people who don't look like themselves, right? Now the more, I'll just take Latinos for example. So the more generations that one is here. If one is a Latino, the more likely that they're going to have been subjected to discrimination, and that's going to affect the way they see things, right? So they're going to see things more commensurate with the ways in which black folks see things, right? But if you are first generation, you're immigrating here, and you're all about America. It's about America. I'm about America. This is why I came here, right? So therefore, they're going to be more hostile towards people who don't look like themselves. They're going to see themselves as more white, and they're going to be more hostile towards people who are not like themselves.
Wow. Awesome. Because I had some interactions with people from those different groups in
mm-hmm.
one setting, and I've seen
mm-hmm.
a stark difference between their philosophy, especially when it came to the Obama election. So you really cleared up a lot of questions that I had, and I didn't know how to articulate the questions. But now I'm clear, and I want to thank
okay.
you.
No problem. You want to talk about my book now? Can we talk
yes.
about my book?
Yes, let's talk about your book.
All right. So my book is about the contributions of black veterans to the civil rights movement. So when people typically hear about the civil rights movement, it's typically about, you know, it's about the black church, or it's about CORE and SNCC, you know, or black colleges and universities. And that's great, and that's been proven, and I think, you know, and I agree with all of that. My argument, however, is that, you know, you can't discount the role that black veterans played in this too, and how the military as an institution, how that helped sow insurgency or the likelihood to resist once you return from the military. And what's so cool about it, Leslie, is that this is a real sort of counterintuitive narrative. And what I mean by that is, you know, I was in the military myself, and the military teaches you about good order and discipline and not to try to change anything. But it was different back then because these guys, and yes, there were a handful of black women as well, who went off to war, and they were wearing a uniform, and they get overseas, and they're getting better treatment from, you know, the indigenous people, right? So let's say if they're serving in Europe or Great Britain, just as an example, they get treated really, really well by the British, right? But you still have white folk who come from the South who want to bring Jim Crow over there with them. And the black soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, they weren't having any of that. So they became accustomed to fighting discrimination in the military, right? So when they get back to the South, it ain't nothing but a thing to them. it's just the same stuff, different location. So it's like if I'm willing to die for my country, you know, trying to preserve these values, I'm willing to die when I get back trying to preserve these values for white, I mean, excuse me, for black folk.
Right. I understand that. You know, we had a guest last week, a professor from Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
and he explained exactly what you're talking about, how the soldiers were mistreated
mm-hmm.
in Hawaii while they were on base because the American soldiers brought that Jim Crow with them.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
they weren't mistreated by the indigenous people of Hawaii.
No, they were not.
That was very disheartening. You know, it's reality, but it was just sad to hear that, you know, you would bring that to somebody else's country and try to spread that in another country.
Yeah, but it gets better. I can give you a couple of examples from my book from some of the veterans I interviewed. So I had one veteran who was in Korea at the time, and he was guarding Korean POWs, just during the Korean War. And the Korean POWs were like, hey, man, hey, black man, why are you trying to fight us? We've done nothing to you. And, you know, he was like, the Korean guy was saying, your people back in the United States, they can't even vote. And mm-hmm. so my man, the black veteran, he was like, you know what? He's right. And so, you know, that made him start thinking about things. That brought him a level of conscious and awareness that he had never had before. Here's another example, Leslie, that will just blow you away. So there was a black man, another Korean War veteran who just got back. He was in Arkansas, full uniform. And he was used to sort of going to the bathroom wherever in Korea, right? So he gets back. He goes to a restroom. Well, he forgot. It was a white restroom, and he's in there, you know, doing his business. And the white man walks up to him and says, and I'm just going to throw it out here just like it is in the book, Leslie. He said, he looked at him and he spit. He said, just because you niggas have a uniform on, you think you're good as a white man. He's like, you niggas still ain't shit, right? Mm. So my man looked at him. He said, Professor, that hurt me. He said, that really hurt my heart, you know, and I wanted to kill him. He said, but you know what? He says, I fought for him to be able to have the right to say that. And that just blew me away. Blew me away.
Right. It's freedom of speech, I guess he was.
Right. Exactly. It's exactly what I'm saying.
Oof. Yeah, well, that is, I mean, you really have to have some strong philosophical views to stand up to that
mm-hmm.
type of criticism.
Mm-hmmm.
I was wondering, do you talk about Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, and his role?
No, I don't, because the book only goes up to the early 1960s, right? Because I'm only looking at, I mean, because if I start getting to Vietnam, that's a whole different book, right? And that's not one, that's going to be part of my next book, but that's not part of the current book.
Okay. From what you know about what happened with Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali,
mm-hmm.
and when you mentioned in your book about what the soldier has said.
Right. You're
talking
about
similar. It sounds similar to what the Vietnamese were saying.
Well, Cassius Clay said, what did he say? A yellow man, they never called me nigger, something like that. It was something
right.
like that, right?
Right.
Similar sentiments, but here's the thing. This is a difference in generations, Leslie, because Cassius Clay was aware of this, right? But my man, who had been living in the South all this time, he had never really stopped to think about it because Jim Crow was so pervasive, right? It was so pervasive that he just thought it was a natural order of things, right? And it wasn't until, you know, this Korean told him this, and it wasn't until he got treated more equitably by some Korean, and also in Hawaii, because folks who were in Korea, veteran or GIs who were in Korea, when they went on R&R, they often went to Hawaii. R&R.
Okay. And
right?
What is R&R?
Rest and recreation.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. And so they were accustomed to getting treated so much better. And so when they come back, they're like, "Wait a minute. This is playing out. We're not going back to this again." Right? We got treated a whole lot better. And not only that, I was willing to fight and I did fight for my country. And that has a huge symbolic meaning attached to it, Leslie. This idea that I'm wearing the same uniform, you know, as these white people over here, you know, as my as whites are, you know, I'm carrying the same guns, and so therefore I see myself as more of a citizen, and even more so as more of a man, right? Because I'm wearing the same uniform, and I got a rifle too. I got a rifle just like them. And so they get this sense of not only entitlement as it becomes attached to the symbolic act of serving in the military, right? But also this is act of, you know, actually fighting, you know, and carrying weapons, right? And it's like they're serving on the same level as these whites are, right? Even though they were in segregated units, right? The whole idea was I'm wearing the same uniform and I'm carrying a weapon just like you.
Right. What comes to mind is the movie A Soldier Story.
I do. Soldiers play, that turns it into a soldier story. That's correct.
Right. Do you see anything that's similar to those scenes, especially the Geechee scene when Sarge went off on one of the
When Sergeant Waters went off on CJ. That's right.
Right.
Could you
explain, you know, the scene and then expand on it?
Well, see, what's going on there is Sarge is playing a role of, you know, he's playing the race man role. He's playing a modified race man role. Let me back up. He's playing a modified race man role. What I mean by that is that's a role by which, you know, you don't want to be seen as weak and stupid, you know, to whites, but in doing so, you know, you don't want people of your race to seem weak and stupid to whites. So you do the best you can to police those people that you perceive as weak and not so bright and that are perpetuating these stereotypes. But by the same token, you sort of it's like the Bledsoe character in Invisible Man, the guy that's the president of the university, right? And he's like, you know, trying to keep all these black folks in line, but at the same time, he's smiling to the white man. Well, that's the same sort of role that I believe, I think his name was Sergeant Waters, I think.
Right, you're right.
The Sergeant Waters, it was played by Adolph Caesar, but Sergeant Waters, same role he was playing, right? That's a sort of trope or stereotype, right? And then CJ, you know, the big, you know, really nice kind of jock and a very athletic, but still, you know, very Southern in his ways, you know, in the sort of Geechee role, you know, that he would strum the banjo and he would, you know, it's a kind of stereotype, you know, quite frankly, that I saw on Martin Lawrence's show that made, you know, some black folks really angry, right? Now, relating this to my So the scene, he upbraided CJ and he got in CJ's grill because CJ was perpetuating these, you know, derogative stereotypes, right?
He thought he was part bird because he said he could fly. He thought he could fly.
He was referring to his baseball playing prowess, right?
Right.
And so what Sarge was upbraiding him about, and CJ didn't understand, was that it's like, look, you know, the more you perpetuate these stereotypes and you act this way in front of these whites, right, the more it keeps us down as a race. Not only you, but us, because they're going to see all of us this way.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the scene. And Sarge really gets on him about this because he eventually tries to get rid of him because Sarge sees him as a detriment to the race, as holding the race back because of these stereotypes that his actions perpetuate.
Right.
So that's that scene. Now, whether or not that played out, you know, well, in my book, I don't really talk about that stuff in my book at all because it's really not relevant. But the ways
black on
in
black,
which it.
Right.
But
we
but,
just talked about black on black. Your book is more or less about white on black.
Yeah, and those particular chapters. And I did have a couple black veterans, you know, whom fighting for democracy, as the book is entitled, really didn't affect because they were like, you know what, I went over there, you know, I didn't really expect anything to change, and when I came back, nothing changed, and I just kind of went on along my way and accepted the way things were. There were a couple folks that were like that, right? There were a couple. Most of them weren't, but there were a couple that were like that.
But But your gentleman from the South who had an eye opener from his colleague, the Korean, his Korean colleague, right?
Yeah.
He
wasn't really a colleague. The guy was a POW.
Oh.
Yeah, the guy I'm talking about, I'm referring to, was guarding the POW. He was actually a POW. And while this guy is guarding him, right, the Korean, who's a POW, is talking to my man who's guarding him and telling him this stuff. He's like, look, man, you guys can't even – he said the English was really good, by the way. He said the guy spoke pretty good English. He said, you guys, why are you fighting us? You guys aren't even free in your own country. You can't vote. You can't do what you want to do. You can't live where you want to live. Why are you fighting us? This guy's a POW, Leslie, telling him this.
Right. Yeah, that's heavy.
Yeah, man, imagine the irony there.
it must have been profound because he shared it with you and it changed his life. But you said before this conversation, he thought this was a natural order.
Yeah, he thought it was a natural order. A lot of these guys thought it was a natural order. You know, I mean, they didn't. It's not something that they willingly submitted to necessarily, but they knew that there wasn't much that they could do about it. But after having worn a uniform and having bore arms for the country and fighting for the country and getting better treatment overseas, they were like, you know what? It is not going down like that when I get back.
So while you interviewed people for the book, did you find – now that would be – he would be more or less the CJ character. Did you interview people who would fall under the realm of Sergeant Waters, who said, I'm going to battle because I think this – I think my input would make a difference and it will bring democracy in my personal life?
Yeah. No. So let me put it like this. There were – people had – two or three different motivations for joining the military and fighting. Some people simply wanted to get away or escape from the crushing poverty of the South, right? That was part of it, right? Some people just wanted to travel, right? And there were a good number of people also who agreed with Sergeant Waters' viewpoint, if that's correct, in that they felt like fighting, you know, would help elevate the race. Right. And let me tell you something, Leslie, even if that wasn't their principal motivation when they left to join the military, that wound up being their motivation when they got out and came back.
Wow.
That their fighting would and their sacrifice would elevate the race. And if it wasn't going to come from, if change wasn't going to come from above, that is to say through legislation from above, then they were going to help fight for it and agitate for it from below. And that's what they did.
Was there one common incident that caused this shift of your views?
It wasn't anything common, but they had a common experience. There wasn't something common that happened to all of them simultaneously,
mm-hmm.
right? Because we're talking about veterans who were in some of whom fought in World War II and served during World War II, and some of whom fought and served in the Korean War, and there was some overlap, about five or six of them served during both wars, but there was not something that happened simultaneously to all of them, right?
Okay.
That changed all their views.
Okay.
It was this common experience, Leslie, that led them to change their views and become more focused on change when they returned home.
Okay. Now, where can we purchase your book? You know, we run out of time. I apologize. If one wants to buy your book, is there a website, email? Can you give us your contact information?
Yes. It can be purchased on Amazon.com. Leslie, can you hold up for a second? Somebody's walking up to the house right now. Can you just hold just for a second?
Okay. We're here, Professor Christopher Parker. He has a book, Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans.
I'm back. Okay, so, yeah, Amazon, you can go to Amazon.com and order it, or you can go to the Princeton University website and order it. My email address, if anybody just wants any further clarification on anything that we discussed, is csparker@u.washington.edu.
Excellent. Now, can we have you back on the show?
I'd be gratified to do so, Leslie. Thanks for the – you had great questions, Leslie.
Oh, thank you so much. And we'll talk again. And enjoy your week, Professor. Keep up the great work.
Thank you very much. You do the same, Leslie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.